ransomware attacks to supply chain compromises, the Cyber Talks podcast will dive into the world of the latest cyber threats and attacks impacting businesses globally. Join us as we speak with industry leaders and practitioners about the cyber risks impacting their businesses and how they're addressing these challenges. Cyber Talks is presented by eCentaur, the authority in managed detection and response. To learn how eCentaur can help your team reduce your cyber risks and build a more resilient security operation, visit eCentaur.com. I'm one of your hosts, Kieran Luttrell, and I'm the Senior Director of Security Services, and I'm based in Cork in Ireland. Hello and welcome to Cyber Talks. My name is Kieran Luttrell. I'm the Senior Director of Security Services here at eCentaur, and I'm based in one of our SOC locations in Cork in Ireland. So today I have Keegan and Brandon with me, and we're going to be discussing a pretty hot topic, the Lockbit ransomware gang. So by now, I'm sure everyone in the cyber industry has heard about the takedown of Lockbit's operations by law enforcement agencies. But if you don't know, we'll just do a high-level recap. So Lockbit is one of the most pervasive and destructive ransomware as a service gangs currently operating worldwide. And to set the stage a bit, the operation involved in the takedown was called Operation Kronos, and it comprised of law enforcement agencies across several countries, many of which were based in the European Union. And the operation resulted in the compromise of Lockbit's primary platform and critical infrastructure, including the takedown of 34 servers and the arrest of two gang members as well. So the UK's National Crime Agency is taking control of the technical infrastructure that allows all elements of the Lockbit service to operate, as well as their leak site on the dark web. So already, this is a pretty massively collaborative effort. I'm not going to go super deep into it just yet. We'll let Keegan and Brandon in just a bit. But it's pretty impressive what these agencies were able to accomplish. So with that being said, in the conversation today, we'll talk about Lockbit, their operations, who they're targeting, their TTPs they're using, and of course, the takedown and resurgence of this gang. So let's go ahead and get started. So first, let's do a round of intros. Keegan, would you like to go first?
Yeah, I'm Keegan. I am on the threat intelligence team, and I'm a senior threat researcher there.
Thank you very much. Brandon.
My name is Brandon Stenzel. I've been with eCentaur 10 years. I manage our SOC incident handling team.
Excellent. And we'll delve into more detail on your roles as we chat through the topic. So, Keegan, I'll start with yourself. We might just go back to the very beginning. Can you tell us a bit about who Lockbit are, how long this gang have been operating, and what we know about them?
Yeah, so around 2020, when the ransomware model was essentially exploding, it had been kind of proven by a couple cyber criminals, and now essentially all the cyber criminals were adopting ransomware as a service. Lockbit popped up, and that was around February 2020. You can find his posts on the dark web forums, offering affiliate services essentially. So since then, it's probably grown into one of the largest ransomware groups. And I say largest mostly because of the volume of stuff we see, the volume of companies we see getting posted on leak sites. And in particular, they tend to, I think one of the reasons they have such a large volume is because they don't have kind of a bar or a threshold for revenue that a lot of other ransomware groups do. So they'll go after small and medium businesses all day, pretty much. And kind of one of the unique things about Lockbit is their kind of PR or their public relations approach. If you go to their Onion website, you're going to see, you know, we're not based out of any one country. We're very open to any religion, any country, puppies and rainbows, and all that stuff. But then you find out that you're not allowed. If you work for them, you can't attack Russia. You can't attack Commonwealth of Independent States, right? So so there's probably some kind of leaning there. And then more recently, Lockbit, kind of on an interesting TTPs level, you know, interesting tactics approach, is they've kind of led the way in shifting away from malware for that initial access and kind of purely using either valid credentials or even for lateral movement later in the chain, they'll be using legitimate programs like ConnectWise and AnyDesk So there's no malware signatures here up until the ransomware is deployed. So they're kind of in many ways kind of living off the land and blending in with valid tools a lot. And that's pretty well known nowadays, but they were really leading the charge with that last year. And that's kind of in a nutshell, LockBit.
Very good. Lot to tease apart there. I might just go a slight bit deeper on one or two of those points, Geegan. You talked there about living off the land, initial access through credential theft and so on. Can we just explore that a little bit more? Why do you feel that's happening? Why are LockBit using those methods?
Well, there's two reasons. Primarily, it lowers detection rates because now there's not a malicious malware signature. Now you're detecting, you know, you're trying to detect things that are valid in the environment. And now you have to detect anomalous usage. Same with VPN credentials. That's somebody logging in with valid credentials. That looks, you know, at the surface, it looks no different than an employee logging in. So there's some advanced sort of building, you know, baselines and looking at that against, you know, your next month of activity. It becomes more fuzzy to detect that stuff rather than it just being a concrete true positive or false positive.
Gotcha, yeah. So if it's trickier to detect that type of activity, is it fair then to assume that they would have a higher success rate using that method as well?
That, and in addition, it makes attribution harder because now there's no specific malware that we know this threat actor uses. Now they're using some very common tool. So that just creates a little bit more time and gap and uncertainty in attribution. And then that's going to prevent law enforcement from putting indictments on specific groups. And then that's going to make it easier for them to get ransoms. So it's a business model. You know, it comes down to the bottom line.
Yeah, that all stacks up. Brandon, I might bring you in here. And before we get into the specifics, I might just get you to kind of talk briefly about the role that you have in eCenter within our Security Operations Center.
Yeah, so our incident handling team is essentially incident response light, as we like to refer to it. Our job is to take any SOC detections, any alerts that we send out to our customers, and take that next step before you can actually get incident response paperwork in place and get the contract signed. So the team is forensically trained. We have a lot of the same skills as a typical digital forensics and incident response employee, but we're using those within the MDR space to get ahead during these incidents. So we'll fire up incident bridges, we'll go on to the various services we have deployed, pull telemetry, pull artifacts, and we'll get a head start on that data collection and really focus on the containment aspect of the incident. Gotcha.
So your team are very much on the front lines of the SOC when it comes to hands-on keyboard threat actor activity. You guys are the ones that are really tearing that apart, I guess, and figuring out what's going on and obviously detecting and responding to it. So to come back to some of the points Geegan made, I think that very much mirrors what we're seeing in the SOC, right? So I suppose I'm standing on the sidelines a bit looking on when these incidents are kicking off and you and your team are investigating them. But we definitely have seen that, right? Where they're using credentials, stolen credentials to get initial access. They're using living off the land tools. Maybe could you kind of elaborate on that, Brandon, from your perspective in terms of incidents that you've dealt with?
Yeah, absolutely. A big chunk of it, as Keegan already alluded to, is we're seeing attackers living off the land, so those tools are already present within the environment. They don't have to transfer their own tools. Everything's already there for them. They can blend in with the environment. Sometimes it can make the activity look legitimate. You start to question on whether, is this a system administrator doing this activity? Is this a threat actor? And even on the customer end, they're not always sure what, like, if it's expected or not.
Perfect, yeah. So Keegan, I'll take it back just to some reports that we wrote and published around LockBit incidents over the past little while. And before we get into the specifics, maybe you might just tell the listeners a little bit about the work that the True team does here in eCenter in terms of research and publishing different reports.
Yeah. So while Brandon's team is a lot on the front end of like the customer interface between threat actors and the customers themselves, we tend to be more kind of in the threat actors side of things, just looking at what they're doing. And then, of course, when Brandon's team finds a bunch of stuff and pulls it out for us to look at, that becomes a lot of the source of our really intimate intelligence that we have, you know, rather than this secondary intelligence that we're getting from other sources external. So kind of putting them all together, it gives us a pretty big vantage point from a threat intelligence perspective, just having that internal and that external perspective. And so with that, we're able to see kind of a lot of what's going on with threat actors and get an idea of where their TTPs are moving kind of as an ensemble, as a whole, as well, 'cause, you know, cyber criminals talk to each other, they're a community, these trends grow and follow in the broader cyber community. So, you know, just trying to watch what they're doing and see where the new techniques are coming from, what's getting popular, what's successful, and then arm the essentially the SOC with both detections and playbooks to help them address and tackle that. And then, of course, we work really closely with the incident handling team. Anything that's new or coming up that's kind of interesting in the security world, we're actively discussing that. Probably any month or week, there's some discussions that are already going on there.
Perfect. And maybe just one small follow-on question from that as well. Cause I guess threat intelligence teams come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Sometimes it's just one senior person doing a lot of work. How do we do this at scale here at eCenter, Keegan? Like, what's the size of the team? How is it structured?
We talk about True and we talk about threat intelligence, and really threat intelligence is part of the bigger True team. And so the way that whole True team is structured helps a lot with our scaling, because we essentially have TTR on the True team, and they're kind of I like to think of them as like the talon of the beast, the arm of the beast. They go out and action our intelligence. So they'll write these rules, make sure the rules, you know, work in the actual production environment. Because when we write these rules in threat intelligence, we're kind of coming from a theoretical pure land. You know, if we had an ideal place to write these rules, TTR team is actively always developing these rules, plus, you know, adding that really that business level and efficiency and optimization perspective to it. And then so that allows threat intel team to just focus on the threat landscape, and allows TTR to just focus on the detection engineering side of things. So that's a pretty huge synthesis there, just being able to do that and kind of have an input and an output function. It allows us to organize, you know, this constantly evolving threat landscape that we're dealing with.
Perfect. Yeah, thanks for the detail. I think that helps us kind of set the scene on the two reports that we're going to delve into in terms of Lockbit specifically. So I think it was September 23, and we published a report on three different Lockbit incidents that happened over a time period of February 22 to June 23. So in each of those, can you just maybe go into some of the research that your team have done on the Lockbit gang and maybe share some interesting facts?
Yeah. And really a lot of this is kind of what we talked about in the beginning. This kind of focus on VPN credentials and this use of valid tools, particularly what we call RMMs, remote management and monitoring tools. They really liked ConnectWise for a while, which is interesting because we're seeing exploitation of ConnectWise recently in association with Lockbit. I think in this case, though, a lot more threat actors are exploiting it. Lockbit's code has been leaked. So it looks like there's other ransomware groups actually deploying that. But it's interesting that like Lockbit was back in 2023, now they're leveraging ConnectWise again. But instead of leveraging it just kind of directly in the environment, they're actually exploiting it, which is gives them a lot more advantage than previously for the initial access side of things.
Yeah. And Brandon, let me bring you back in here. Why, in your view, are these RMM tools so problematic? Because I know we've seen it time and again in the SOC where they are being exploited by threat actors. Like, why is it so, well, it sounds like it's easy almost for them to use these tools. You know, why is that happening in your view?
One of the big trends we see is a lot of customers use these tools legitimately. So with something like ConnectWise, we see that across a lot of our customers in the customer base. So if you already have that installed on, let's say, 150, 200 different machines, your access is very easy at that point. Once you get into the server, you can just push out additional payloads from that software. You've got an administrator shell on each system. It really makes moving around the environment quite easy.
Gotcha. But is there inherent vulnerabilities within these tools, or are they poorly configured or mismanaged, or is it a combination of all of the above, really?
Absolutely a combination. We see poor misconfigurations, but we also see a lot of, and this isn't limited to anything like ConnectWise. We see a lot of patch management issues across different different vendors, different products.
Yeah, thanks, Brandon. Those are good points. So I think it was last week you and I presented to our global sales team at their kickoff, and we talked about some stories from the SOC, and one of them was related to Lockbit, where we prevented a deployment. So maybe at a high level, Brandon, can you maybe talk us through that example for our listeners in terms of what we detected, what the TTPs were, and how the story evolved, I suppose.
Yep, absolutely. This incident happened a few months ago. On day one, what happened was we found a PS exec executable masquerading as a legitimate Windows service on one system. Turned out the system was a Citrix host. We escalated to the customer, had them reimage the machine. Didn't know the situation in the environment. Everything seemed like it was contained and remediated. The next day, we started to see malicious PowerShell remote access Trojan registration. We started to see zip files being downloaded, connections out to a ransomware associated domain. And this follow-up activity started on additional Citrix hosts other than the one from day one. So the time between these events, initially from day one to day two, we're looking at around 34 hours. On day two, these events were within, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of one another, and you could start to see things progressing. So it went from, you know, command and control a couple times, then you start seeing privilege escalation, recon within the environment, data exfiltration. So we jump on a bridge with the customer. We get the incident handling team. We get the customer. We get a few members of our IR team getting visibility into this. And really, at that point, you're on a 12-hour bridge. You're going through every host in the environment, looking for compromised accounts, compromised machines, evidence of what we're seeing. And it came to be later that this customer is vulnerable to a critical Citrix vulnerability. So there was advisories published a month prior, and unfortunately they hadn't applied those patches, and it just happened to be their time to, you know, be exploited by that. And, you know, as we did our investigation, we started to see zip file downloads. We were able to extract those from network packet captures and determine that Lockbit payloads were included within those zip archives. Fortunately, through quick action on our side and the customer side, we were able to put an end to that and get them into a good state within, you know, 36, 48 hours.
Very good. One thought comes to mind there. You mentioned an unpatched Citrix vulnerability that had been exploited. And I think you said it had been a month or so old that patches had been available. You know, we hear a lot in the industry about zero-day vulnerabilities, and there's a lot of talk around those. But in your experience, is it equally as prevalent where existing vulnerabilities that are unpatched are being exploited, or is it a mix? And why is that? Is it, again, just sort of substandard patch management practices, or like, what's your experience around that?
Yeah, it's a combination of patch management processes. It's also, in some cases, it's customers not being aware of what actually is deployed within the environment. For something like ConnectWise, you get some shadow IT where they don't know it's deployed with things like VPN endpoints. Sometimes they have the understanding that maybe they retired that particular appliance and it's just sitting out there ready to be exploited.
Okay, so it's kind of comes into the realm of asset management, and you said shadow IT and so on. Yeah, okay. So Keegan, I might come back to yourself and just talk a bit more about Operation Kronos with you. I suppose, look, from my reading into this, it feels like it was quite a bold operation in terms of almost felt like they were kind of rubbing the ransomware gang's faces in the dirt a little bit, kind of causing reputational damage, you know. How does this compare in your experience with previous takedowns? Because there have been others, obviously.
Previous takedowns, they've been a lot quieter first. You don't really hear much about it. There's a takedown one day, and then it's a news cycle, and it's gone, and you forget about it. And it's just one static page the FBI usually puts up. Well, Interpol, the whole organization of international law enforcement. But, you know, they just have one static page that says this page has been seized. But this time they actually took over the blog posts, and they started using those blog posts to threaten to dox the threat actors, to threaten to take down infrastructure. So they had the countdown timer on a post, you know, that was coming up where they were going to take down an affiliate infrastructure. Or so they alluded to. And then they had one where they were going to dox the threat actors. And at this point, they had already doxed a couple of affiliates, though there is some discussion that they got the affiliates wrong. But nonetheless, people were arrested. So there's a lot of intimidation going on there on law enforcement side, and a lot of withholding information and then publishing that information. So law enforcement's really engaging in the information warfare, kind of in the way that ransomware actors have been known to do. So very, very interesting, definitely orchestrated, and you know, that very, very much intentional that it's lined up with the way ransomware attackers attack people. So yeah, very a first for me to observe something like that, definitely. And it's such a big scale too. I mean, one local police station doing something like that wouldn't be surprising, but that was a huge international effort. Yeah, I was pretty entertained and amused by that whole thing.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, I found it quite entertaining as well. Why do you think that they decided to go that route? I mean, as you say, it marks a bit of a change from just a single page from the FBI or something. They're kind of playing the ransomware threat actors at their own game a little bit from a PR perspective. Like, why do you think that's happening?
Yeah, so I think the technical side of the takedown is what they've always done before, and that's what they still did this time. But as we're observing, the technical takedown is really just a delay for them, right? They're going to either, in Lockbit's case, they're not even rebranding yet. But often in the past, we've just seen threat actors rebrand to a new ransomware brand. They still have all of the techniques. They still have probably protection from the nation that they're operating under. So we can't do much from the U.S. for them. This is kind of tackling the problem more in the social way. You know, this is propaganda, essentially. It's information warfare. So it's, you know, it's causing kind of more of a psychosocial deterrent to ransomware actors. It's making the consequences look scarier. You know, all the kind of the social side of it rather than just the technical. And I think that's good. That's an enhancement. I mean, it's not going to bring you up to 100%. Takedown, but I think it's got a couple more percentage points than just the technical side.
So your hope is that might be an effective technique by law enforcement to kind of discourage the affiliates from using that service moving forward.
Well, yeah, and you can't just do it once. You this has to be something that keeps happening, and kind of raises the stress and anxiety that those ransomware actors, because they feel, you can see in their chats, you know, when there's been chats released by hackers, you see when they go through these anxious, paranoid periods where they can't sleep at night. I mean, that stuff is real. That psychological impact is real. So, and they know that, and that's probably kind of what they're going for there.
Yeah. You touched there on, you know, when these have happened in the past, that the gangs will regroup or rebrand. So, I mean, in your view, Keegan, like, should we be sort of celebrating this as a win, or should we be more cautious that, look, it is likely that this will just continue under another name? Or is this, it's a bit of a different experience this time because of what we just talked about there in terms of how they're engaging in information warfare.
It's a little bit of both. You kind of have to, I mean, if you think about, you know, any law enforcement institution that's been fighting crime for thousands of years or hundreds of years or whatever, it's always going to be there. These are wins. We can't think of it as we've won the war. But it's a constant attrition war that's going to go on probably for our foreseeable future until we, you know, reach progressive levels of Star Trek or something. We're always going to have crime and poverty and all those social stigmas. And that's just part of life. And it's just winning each battle and staying on top of the attrition war rather than seeing it as, you know, oh, I'm done. I won the attrition war. It's just going to be an ongoing battle.
So I suppose maybe, Brandon, I'll come back to you with that in mind, given that we foresee this continuing, and Keegan talked about this being a continuous long-term battle, and we come back to how Lockbit have operated in terms of their methods of gaining initial access, living off the land and so on. Like, what are the best ways that organizations can protect themselves and defend themselves against this type of threat moving forward, in your view?
So by far our favorite tool for this is EDR everywhere. One of the big issues with this that we've encountered in the past is visibility within the EDR platforms. So sometimes you get an environment where they've decided they don't want to put EDR on their critical servers, or they have dark corners in the environment or data centers that they've forgotten about. These are usually the spots that we see ransomware start from. And then by that point, you're already looking at your first detection is ransomware deployment. So ideally, you want to have that everywhere, 100% coverage. I know it's not always feasible, different platforms and such. But if you can get full coverage, that gives you the best chance at detecting this early. Other things are the recommendations we've been saying until we've been blue in the face for years. So patch management, we get that critical advisory from Citrix or your Fortinet device, whatever the case may be. Patch it ideally that day or that week. Don't wait a couple months to do it. Multi-factor authentication, that's another thing we encounter a fair amount. We're trying to push that everywhere. Everyone's bringing it up. It's not always deployed. It's a surefire way of at least stopping that VPN access in particular. And then finally, poor password hygiene. Sometimes you see some old development accounts or test accounts with the password set to test. That's a surefire way to get someone in your environment.
And just leaving those test accounts, they give them so many privileges often because, it's something they just want to get some prototype out. So they give it a bunch of privileges and then they often just leave them and leave this one account with a bunch of privileges hanging out.
So and just recently, actually, I had a test account with domain admin credentials or privileges. So you don't want to see that.
Yeah, no, a lot of good points made there. I might even just recap on the first one, really, because you said you gave so much good feedback there. But you talked about EDR everywhere. And again, looking out from the sidelines when these incidents are kicking off, the ones that tend to end quickly from our perspective are the ones that we lack visibility on, right? We don't have EDR deployed in the different parts of the infrastructure. And unfortunately, then our visibility is limited. And as you said, sometimes the first sign we see of trouble is when ransomware is actually being deployed. And compare that to what we talked about earlier, where the customer involved had a good deployment of EDR and other tools, and we were able to see the early signs of that ransomware before it even kind of got downloaded to the hosts there. So, sorry, Keegan, you were going to come in there with another point.
Yeah, I was just riffing on what you're saying there. One of the first things threat actors do when they hit an environment is they run the process list and look at what processes are there. And if they see a defense tool, they may look around a little bit more. But if they see there's no defense tools, that becomes their staging ground. And, they're going to sit there and set up for a day and they're going to be invisible, more or less. And then, as Brandon said, now you when you finally see stuff, it's when they move off of that and start deploying ransomware to computers in the environment. So that's late in the stage to be detecting stuff. So it's really nice to have that endpoint on the patient zero when you have that.
Yeah, I think you'd agree. If we look at the MITRE framework, you want to shift left.
Yeah.
Move all the detections to the left.
Yeah.
Okay, we're kind of coming to the end of the episode, but I have a kind of a parting question, I think, for both of you, really. What we talked about just now was in relation, I think, mostly to technology in terms of EDR and detections and so forth. But a lot of our listeners will be involved in security teams. They may be a SOC analyst or run a security operations center. And I think training and enabling your SOC team to be able to defend successfully against gangs such as Lockbit that are using living off the land and all of that, we know that's increasingly difficult as well. It's not something you can just create runbooks for and have SOC analysts kind of follow instructions on. So maybe I'll come to you first, Brandon. What are your thoughts on how people working in this field can really sort of up their game to be able to successfully thwart these types of attacks? Is there any tips or feedback you'd have there, again, from incidents that you've worked on?
I'm a big fan of advanced security training, especially with a hands-on component. Extending beyond that, I highly recommend it that individuals seek out write-ups on different incidents. Sometimes you can get full ransomware write-ups or analysis of new pieces of the malware. I think that's really helpful, really critical in understanding how to deal with it when it happens to your organization. Beyond that, I had something.
We'll come back to you. Keegan, do you want to maybe get in there at all?
Yeah, I'm going to give the threat intelligence answer here. It's really just paying attention to the threat landscape and seeing what, every opportunity you can to gather intelligence about what threat actors are doing, that puts you ahead. And that goes back to kind of what we were talking about that transition from these, you know, identifiable malware executables to now living off the land. Now it becomes behavioral, it becomes more fuzzy, and it evolves and changes, you know, almost quarter to quarter. So if you're not paying attention to the threat landscape, it's going to be a lot harder to divide legitimate behavior from malicious behavior when it's getting this fuzzy. So really keep an eye on the threat landscape. Know your enemy, know your threat actors.
I would add on to that. Don't be afraid to take a system offline or to stop a process running on a machine. If you're not sure, take it offline, do your analysis, and then come back to it.
Yeah, Brandon, we do see that a bit, right? So here in eCenter, we've got the ability to respond to threats by isolating hosts and disabling users and so on. But we do sometimes get pushback, right, from clients saying, well, please release that host from isolation. Everything is fine. And that can cause challenges when there's legitimately malicious activity happening, right? I think you've seen that on occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a big difference between taking a user or a machine offline for a couple hours versus having your entire environment offline for 2 weeks. So, I mean, it should be an easy decision to decide which path you want to take.
Yeah, when these guys get hands-on, these are professionals. The threat actors, they're professionals. When they get hands-on, they mean business, for sure. And some people don't realize that, how serious it is.
Very good. All right. Well, on that note, we might leave it. I really enjoyed chatting to you guys. Thanks so much for your time. And to everybody listening, I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. And stay tuned for other episodes in the series. Bye for now. Learn how eCenter can help your team reduce your cyber risks and build a more resilient security operation. Visit eCenter.com.